We're in Acts chapter 15. If you were with us last week, you know that we took one of what I hope to do as far as two special studies. We talked about command, example, inference, and didn't get to silence, so we want to talk about, as far as the beginning of class today, silence. We have all four of those items listed in Acts chapter 15. When we think about how the Bible authorizes us to do things, permits us to do things, and what the Bible forbids, commands, examples, inference, and silence are four of the ways that we use in Scripture to determine what's right, what's wrong, and we also use those four things in our daily lives. For example, if you were to go to the refrigerator this morning and you found some milk in there, you didn't buy the milk, there's only one other person in your household, a spouse, and nobody's been to your house in 6 months, could you infer something about the milk?
It's expired.
Well, all right. That might be one thing. That's not exactly the direction that I was headed, but we would infer that it's expired because after 6 months, it's obviously gone bad. What else can you infer?
The spouse.
Your spouse bought it.
Your spouse bought it. Nobody else has been in the house. You didn't buy it, and you've not forgotten, so your spouse had to buy it. There was no mouse that brought the milk in that's now expired, okay? Now, even though we know that, what happens sometimes? The spouse goes to the other spouse and says, Did you buy the milk? Well, of course you did. Well, why say that? To generate a conversation. Maybe you're thinking, did you buy the milk? And then did you also buy the cereal? And did you buy the eggs and those things? But we infer that the spouse bought the milk. We use that kind of thing 1,000 times a year, but we never think about it. Perhaps we never know that it's never consider that it's called inference, but that's what it is. So we want to finish up Bible authority today. Take just a few minutes for that. Next week, I'm hoping to talk about false teachers because that's also a big thing in Acts chapter 15. So let's go back and talk about silence for just a little bit. If you were not in last week's class where we sort of ended, I introduced it and made the point that 500 years ago or thereabouts, there was this huge religious debate. It's known as the Reformation. And there were two fellows who were sort of at two polar extremes. There was this one guy by the name of Martin Luther. And anybody know what Martin Luther believed and taught? Lutheran said, if it's not specifically prohibited in the Bible, if God didn't specifically say don't do it, then what? It's okay. Well, are there some problems with that view? Yeah. If you take that view, remember how we ended the illustration in life. You're going to place an Amazon order, right? And you tell Amazon you want a new toaster. So you get out your phone or you get out your computer and you say, Amazon, send me a new toaster. That's your entire order. But what's Amazon send you?
Most expensive.
Well, not just that. They send you all the appliances and then they begin to send you some paper products. And you call Amazon up and say, I didn't order those things. And what's Amazon's reply?
You didn't say,
don't send those things. We all understand the principle there. You don't have to go through, and if Amazon has 10 million items, you don't have to list all 10 million items that you don't want. When you specify what you want, and you're specific, that excludes some of the things. Well, how does that help us when it comes to the Bible? You specify what you want, and that excludes some of the things. If God says sing, Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16, then what does that do? That's his stated will. You don't start adding things. He doesn't specifically have to say, don't play. Well, we mentioned the other guy. His name was Zwingli. And Zwingli was headed in a more biblical direction. What was Zwingli's idea? You have to have authority for what you're going to do. And that's how we operate today in the secular realm. And that's how we're supposed to operate in the spiritual realm. Okay, the Bible, if it were to list every possible act that's wrong, it'd be a really thick book. You could never get through it. And yet sometimes that's the mentality that people have. A person will come along and say, well, show me where the Bible says don't do it. If that's the way that you're understanding the Bible, then take that principle and just magnify it towards everything that you can imagine. Where does the Bible say it's wrong to have a pope? Where does the Bible say it's wrong to have cardinals? Where does the Bible say it's wrong to worship the preacher? You're not going to be able to find all those things in Scripture as far as a direct statement or even example. You have to use inference and sometimes, as we're going to talk about here in just a moment, silence. Let's talk about silence. Right now, if you are a Verizon cell phone customer, you're 55 years of age and you live in the state of Florida, you can get a really good deal on a cell phone. But somebody says, we're not someone who's living in the state of Florida. We live in Montana or Connecticut. And we're only 45. Well, you call Verizon up and say, I want that deal. What are they going to tell you? You don't qualify. But you say, now, wait a minute. Where does it say you have to only live in Florida? Where does it specifically say Connecticut is prohibited? Well, the offer doesn't read that way. It just says you have to live in Florida and you have to be 55 years of age or older. By stating the conditions and being silent about all the other states and all the other ages, they don't have to go down to, you know, 54, 53, 52, 51, all the way down to zero. They state the conditions, and by stating the conditions, what are they affirming? You meet the conditions and you qualify for the offer. If you don't live in this state, if you are under this age, even if you live in the state of Florida, you do not qualify. Now, some people might say, well, that's not fair, that's not right, and you can argue that. But the silence prohibits that. Where do we see silence in the Old Testament? One of the first stories. Worldwide basis. Well, I was thinking a little later, not from Genesis 4, but Genesis 6. The ark, right? God said, build an ark. Build it out of what kind of wood? Gopher. Did God have to specify, don't use walnut, and don't use oak, and don't use birch, and don't use beech, and 1,000 other woods? No. When he says, do it this way, what's he? It's like our order from Amazon. Send me this. And because I'm telling you what to do, don't do the other stuff. That is not authorized. I have told you what you need to do. Singing, as we said, is an example. Sometimes when people talk about Bible silence, I'm not sure they understand exactly what that means. But silence is not literally silent. Silence, as we talk about it from the standpoint of Bible authority, is that God has said do this. He's given us a specific will. And when he specifies something, you don't do something else. Leaving the book of Genesis, skipping Exodus, what do we find in Leviticus chapter 10? There are two guys who are priests. Anybody remember their names? Nadab and Abihu. And what happened to those fellows? They lived long, prosperous lives. They died. Why? Strange fire. Why was it strange? God said, if you're a priest, you get fire from here. Did God have to say, don't get fire from these 10,000 other spots? Didn't have to do that. Why? Because he said, this is the way to do it. Just like build the ark, just like sing. And if you don't do that, you're doing the same thing that you did do to Amazon. You know, why did you send me these 10 million items? Well, you didn't specifically say you don't want them. We cannot function in society if that's the way that we work. Ingredients to products. If the ingredients and the products are listed, somebody says, I have an allergic reaction to soy. Well, that's fine. And you're reading through the products on the ingredient list and nothing is said about soy. Now, if they have truly listed the ingredients there, they've complied with federal law, and no soy is listed there unless there's an error, what are you able to infer? There is no soy in the product. Expiration dates, going back to Ray's illustration as far as the spoiled milk. If the milk says that it's going to expire on the 20th of this month, does it then have to say it's going to be bad after the 21st and the 22nd and the 23rd and so forth? No, it doesn't. Why? Because it has given you the date. And with that, there is not only silence there about the other dates, but you also are able to infer, you should have enough sense. What about when it comes to posted hours? We're open Monday through Friday from 10 to 5. Does it have to say on the sign that they're not going to be open at 9 o'clock in the evening? It doesn't have to say that. The Bible is silent about being open at 9. And if somebody showed up at 9 and then harasses them the next day, I was here at 9 o'clock. Why weren't you open? Well, the sign says 10 to 5. And with that stated information, you're to infer from that that we're not going to be open at hours other than that if indeed we're following the information that is on the sign. The warranties, the contracts that we have, we use that again and again. Here's one more illustration, not to belabor the point too much longer. Somebody says, can I be baptized in a pile of dirt? Now, I've never heard anybody ask that or say that, but let's say somebody says, I have a phobia to water, but I'm okay with being baptized in sand or water. Just cover me up and then dig me out. Now, if somebody asked you that, what would you say? Is that right or wrong? Does the Bible specifically say you can't be baptized in sand?
No.
Not there. Bible specifically say you can't be baptized in dirt? No. Well, then if you use Luther's theology, that must be right. If it's not specifically prohibited, it's okay. But why would that not be right? Because God has, we have an example of that. We have commands. You know, here's water. What has hindered me to be baptized? You know, do it. And those things. So Bible authority is so helpful to us, so critical to us. And if you fail to follow that, you're not going to do well with God. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with Acts 15? All right, I would like to get a Galatians reader on tap. Especially Galatians 2, I'm going to be pulling from you for some passages there, but we'll also have probably a passage or two read from Galatians 6. Anybody? All right, Betty, as we need it, we'll ask you for Galatians. All right, Acts 15, 1 and 2. And certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, saying, except ye be circumcised after the custom of Moses, ye can't be saved. And when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and questioning among them, the brethren appointed that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. We introduced this 2 weeks ago, so I just want to highlight some things. Paul and Barnabas, they have finished their first missionary journey. They go back to where they started. That's Antioch of Syria. And now as they're in Antioch of Syria, taking a little downtime, perhaps trying to figure out what to do next, you have these fellows from Judea or Jerusalem. They show up at Antioch. And they are people who are Christians, but they are also people who are false teachers. Betty, let's go to you and see if we can introduce Galatians 2:12. I told you that there are a lot of people, I'm included in this number, who think that Acts 15 and Galatians 2 are, they go hand in hand. Likely, I suspect the Galatian letter was written just prior to what you have in Acts 15. But we're dealing with the same people, Galatians 2:12.
For before some people came from James, he ate with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision.
Is that 2:12? Okay, thank you. So you've got these fellows, they come up from Jerusalem. James is there. They come up for a visit. And as you look through Galatians 2, he talks about the fact that they came out to spy out the liberty. I think we'll pick that up a little bit later as well. We mentioned 2 weeks ago that as there's this discussion taking place at Antioch, it's a very intense discussion. It's almost like there is a debate. Some think that all debating is wrong. Acts 15:2 indicates that that is simply not true. You have Paul and Barnabas. They're working to try to convert these people to the truth. And maybe the apostles had gone back. I'll mention this a little bit later as well and talked about the conversion of Cornelius, but it wasn't enough for these people. I almost wonder, can't say this for sure, but if the apostates were saying something like, if you don't believe that we're teaching the truth, where did we just come from? Betty read it in Galatians 2:12. We just came from Jerusalem. And you know the apostles are there. So if we came from Jerusalem, we must have permission or authority or the right doctrine, otherwise we would have been stopped. Sometimes you'll find that people will challenge you. Well, if you don't believe me, then just go check. Well, if that's what they were hoping that Paul and Barnabas would be stopped by as far as that threat, it didn't work. Paul and Barnabas, they were willing to go to Jerusalem and check things out. And that, of course, would have been a trip of about 300 miles. Let this point sink in. Here are these guys. They make the 300 or so mile trip to Jerusalem, or from Jerusalem to Antioch. They're trying to teach this false doctrine. Paul, you would think that if anybody could convert somebody to the truth, it would have been him. Paul and Barnabas, they have this great, this intense, this long, this virtual debate with these fellows. And do these guys change? No. Because Paul and some others have to go to Jerusalem. It's very, very important to remember that as we deal with people who are involved with some kind of false doctrine, oftentimes they're going to cling to that, they're going to be stubborn, and not let it go. As I said, we don't know how Paul exactly argued his case. We're going to see later in Acts chapter 15 that when Peter gets involved with this discussion in Jerusalem, he's going to go back and, among other things, point out the conversion of Cornelius, which would have been about 10 years prior to this time, and maybe Paul appealed to that as well. But it's very, very difficult sometimes to get people to renounce their error, and that's true here. when you look at the words that Luke uses, there are four different words in the New Testament to describe a lack of unity or disagreement. And the word that's used here is also used in some other places like Acts chapter 15, not only Acts 15, 2, but Acts chapter 23, verse 7, Acts chapter 23 and verse 10. And it's a word, I'll give you this quote, which describes a strong disagreement, but there's no fracture yet. That is, it doesn't look like Paul and Barnabas were telling the Christians in Antioch, let's mark these people and let's cast them out of the church. So these people were misinformed. They were teaching what was wrong, but still there was an effort apparently to salvage them. So they're willing to take the 300-mile trip to go down to Jerusalem and try to show them that their belief was wrong. And that's really commendable. There are some other words. You see some intensification. There's another word which means standing apart. That's used in places like Galatians 5 and verse 20. There's another word which is translated schisma. Sounds like schism. That would be a severe tear. That's used in places like 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 18. And then you have a final word which sounds like heresy. And that would describe a mature separation used in places like Acts chapter 24 and verse 5. Now as you look at what we read in Acts chapter 15, you have Paul going to Jerusalem. You have Barnabas going to Jerusalem. But was anybody else going to go to Jerusalem? All right. We think that Titus went as well. And you picked it up from the information that we have, especially in the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 1. Betty, are you there?
Galatians 2:1.
Yeah. Okay, now if this is, as I said, information which is parallel to Acts chapter 15, and I think that there's a lot of reasons to believe that it is, Paul says, been a while since I've been at Jerusalem, but because of this big contention up here in Antioch of Syria, I and some others were willing to take that 300-mile one-way trip to Jerusalem and sort this out with a false teacher. So he said, I went, Barnabas went, Titus went, and we're going to find some specific reasons associated with Titus's going in just a bit. And then likely some others went along as well. Anybody ever talk to the Jehovah's Witnesses and they bring up Acts chapter 15? If the JWs ever talk to you, and you may find this with some other groups as well, they're going to tell you that Paul and the other people in this delegation, they went to Jerusalem to vote on this matter. Jerusalem is what happened there as far as this quote-unquote conference. Everybody gets down there and they throw this up for a vote and then they decide, well, this is what we need to do with Gentiles and the circumcision. Well, that's not what was going on. And the text makes that very, very clear. Anybody in Acts chapter 15 and want to skip down to verse 28 and read that for us? Acts 15, verse 28. Brian?
For it seemed good to the Holy Ghost and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things.
All right. Seemed good to us after we voted. Oh, no. Seemed good to who? The Spirit. The Spirit had already determined what was right and wrong. We see that at the household of Cornelius. Brian, you want to back up a little bit and read Acts chapter 15 and verse 7.
And when there had been much disputing, Peter rose up and said unto them, Men and brethren, ye know how that a good while ago God made choice among us, that the Gentiles by my mouth should hear the word of the gospel and believe.
Okay, now these are two verses. If you don't underline them, try to at least commit them to memory. Holy Spirit had already decided this issue, verse 28. When Peter has a chance to speak to the delegation at Jerusalem, verse 7, he says, how long ago? A good while ago. Well, if he's going back, and I'll mention this probably again, but if he's going back to the events at Cornelius' house, he's going back roughly 10 years. Approximately 10 years from the day of Pentecost to the conversion of Cornelius, and then roughly another 10 years from the conversion of Cornelius to Acts chapter 15. About a dozen years had passed, and Peter goes back to that, and he says, a long time ago, this had already been established that the Gentiles were going to be saved or justified in the same way. Betty, back to you, if you will, Galatians chapter 2 and verse 2.
I went up by revelation.
Okay, let me just stop you right there. I went up how? By revelation? God was involved with this, and what else does he say? There it is. Paul said, I preach this gospel among the Gentiles. If you're preaching the gospel to the Gentiles, you're telling them how to be saved? Yeah? Paul says, look, I've been doing this for a long time. He didn't need to figure out what the truth was 14 years later. He knew the truth. He was preaching the truth. This information in Acts chapter 15 was not to vote. Here's what it was for, though. Remember, think about what we have. We've got Paul, Barnabas, coming back, first missionary journey. They're up there in the area of Antioch. We've got these visitors that Betty read about from Galatians chapter 2 and verse 2. They're false teachers. They come up, and they start telling the brethren, if you're a Gentile, you've got to follow the law of Moses. Paul and Barnabas, they've got this big dispute going on, and Paul is not very successful with that. Had the brethren at Antioch recognized Paul's authority, what should have been done? What should they have done with those false teachers? They should have said, who do we have sitting in the pew over here? Paul. Who is he? He's an apostle of Christ. How fully is he an apostle compared to Peter and the others? He's equal. And if this guy, by inspiration, is telling you what? The Gentiles are people who need to do the same things as the Jews. There's nothing extra that they need to do. They are not accountable to the Jewish law. If that's what that guy is telling you by inspiration, then guess what? That settles the matter. There's no question about the truth. These guys are wrong. Apparently, though, for whatever reason, maybe the false teachers were very persuasive, but the Christians at Antioch did not, from what I can tell, fully accept Paul's authority. And that was a problem. I imagine that was distressing to Paul. But did Paul throw up his hands and quit and say, well, you guys have rejected my authority. I'm through with you. I'm going to go somewhere else. What did he say? All right, Barnabas, pack the bags. What are we going to do? I mean, we've talked to these guys, we work with these people, and now what's the next step? We're not going to go vote on it, but what are we going to do? We're going to go back. These guys came from Jerusalem, so we're going to go back to the source of the problem, and what are we going to do? We're not going to try to just chop off a couple leaves. We're going to go to the root, and we're going to pluck this out. When you look at Paul's character, you have to look at him, especially in this light, and say he really was a great man, not only an evangelist, but someone who really went to the nth degree, went to the second mile in trying to help these people understand and follow the truth. Brian?
I think of chapter 14, Paul and Barnabas had told everybody what three things God had done among the Gentiles by them. On the way to Jerusalem, they're telling Christians all along the way what God's done among the Gentiles.
Yeah.
And then even in Jerusalem, right in the middle of that chapter, they point to that. So even God is attesting to the truth of the gospel that they've been preaching.
Yeah.
And so they aren't just rejecting Paul's authority, they're rejecting God. Because God gave testimony with the miracles.
Yes, that is right. And as we continue to build this, hopefully by the end of the class, you'll be able to look back at Acts chapter 10 and Acts chapter 11 and understand that even better. But a little more before we get to that. Acts 15, 3 and 4. They therefore, there is a conclusion based on all the things that we've talked about. Therefore, being brought on their way by the church, passed through Phoenicia and Samaria, declaring the conversion of the Gentiles. And they caused great joy unto all the brethren. Verse 4. And they were come to Jerusalem, and they were received of the church, and the apostles, and the elders. And they rehearsed all the things that God had done through them. Paul and Barnabas, they've made this decision, verse 2, to go to Jerusalem to discuss the issue of circumcision with others, not to vote. And now you have, there is some discussion in Acts chapter 15 and verse 3 about what's taking place. Did the church simply come out to say goodbye to them, send them off? I think that's probably true. Or did the church actually fund their trip? I also think that's true. I remember one of my first trips to Russia. It was kind of a rough trip. I'd been gone for probably about 5 weeks. And when I showed up at the airport, I probably looked like a wet dog. But I do remember that basically the entire congregation came out and said, welcome home. Now, for me, that was kind of the flip. It was saying welcome back versus we wish you well on the trip. But that can be a really fine thing for a congregation to do. To assemble. Sometimes after a person is baptized, you have everybody come up and encourage the new person. That can be a great, great thing. And it seems like they, even though they had some problems with Paul's authority on accepting this issue, they were willing to fund the trip and were willing to give him a very good send-off. Paul and Barnabas, as you see from the text, they were passing through Phoenicia, Samaria. And as they're in those places, as Brownwin was talking about a bit ago, they're talking about the conversions of the Gentiles. You have at least some of the Samaritans being converted. We saw that as early as Acts chapter 8. Remember, there's Philip. He goes into the area of Samaria. He's preaching, meets up with some people like Simon the sorcerer. And as you look at the end of verse 3, what's said about the reports concerning these Gentiles? Christians in these areas, they begin to hear that Gentiles have been converted, and what are they thinking? Oh boy, we're not going to welcome them. There's joy. And not only is there joy, there's great joy. That joy is described with the imperfect tense. It was ongoing action. People were thrilled that Gentiles were coming to Christ. When we hear about people being baptized into Christ today, that should be something that stirs our souls in a good way. The word all at the end of verse 3 certainly stresses the point. You have the trip from Antioch to Jerusalem. It's described as successful. The delegation gets to Antioch, and who meets them? Who's there to say, glad you're here? All right, the church. That certainly should have been encouraging to them, but who else is specifically singled out? The apostles. And along with the apostles, we also read about the elders. And all of those people are going to be important, as we see from verse 5 and following. The latter part of verse 4, I think, is a good reminder to us that as you look at the first century and you see that apostles and elders were both put into the church by God, did the apostles replace the elders? No. Did the elders replace the apostles? No. What do you have? Two different groups of men doing two different things, but still, what are they doing? Working together. That's a model for us today. You might be in this group, quote-unquote. You might be in that group, quote-unquote, doing different things, and that's perfectly fine. But God's will is that we all work together, regardless of gender, role, all of those things. A wonderful lesson for us. All right, then you also have the report. This is similar to Acts chapter 14 and verse 7. God is the one who's credited with doing great things among the Gentiles. God and the saved were like partners, and that's still true today. So we also want to be mindful of that today. Can't do anything without God. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at Acts 15:5?
When Paul and Barnabas went to Jerusalem, they went down there with the intention of putting out God's word to the elders and the apostles that were there. I don't think they went down there to argue.
No.
I think the elders and the apostles down there probably might have been a little bit surprised at that maybe they were wrong. The apostles and the elders were wrong. So they were at least interested enough to hear what Paul and Barnabas had to say and listen to them very well.
Yeah. Communication. Very, very important. Anybody else? Okay, let's see what we've got over there in Acts chapter 15 and verse 5. But there rose up certain of the sect of the Pharisees who believed, saying, it is needful to circumcise them and to charge them to keep the law of Moses. They get to Jerusalem. They get this warm welcome. But how long does it sound like things stayed on the warm and friendly channel? Not too long. They knew that there was business to attend to, and it seems like they got to that fairly quickly. You read about this certain sect of the Pharisees. And that's interesting for a couple of reasons. Number one, you have a lot of Pharisees during the life of Jesus. They see his miracles. He's, for example, Luke chapter 7, I believe, Jesus was at the home of Simon the Pharisee, and you have there the information about the lady who came up behind Jesus. She washed his feet, and the Lord responds to her in a good way, said her sins were forgiven, and Simon's thinking, you know, if this guy was really some prophet, he'd know what manner of woman that is. And Simon didn't have very good appreciation for Jesus, and there were some others, but this indicates that there were some Pharisees who did become Christians, but they still had some issues. That's a good point to stop and make. You have today some people who become Christians, but do they still have some of the old ideas that they cling to for a while?
Yes.
They do. Old habits are hard to break. Old beliefs can be tough to shed. And sometimes those things linger for a long time, and in some cases, as we see here, that can be a problem. All right, what do these Pharisees claim? They believed something, and they said something. They said, it is neat. Oh, that's really good. I don't know what translation that is. The ASV says it's needful, which doesn't sound like it's too essential, but necessary is... All right, New American Standard. That is an excellent rendering. Anybody have anything else?
ESV is necessary as
well. Okay. Okay, all those are good. Remember that little word, that verb that we talk about, dei, D-E-I? I've given you the illustration. If you're going to have a triangle, can you have two sides? Four sides? It's necessary to have how many sides for the triangle? Three. That's the same word that's used here. They said it is necessary. It is required. It is absolutely essential. Sometimes a person will come along and say, well, I believe, I think I'd really like it to be this way. And then there's some other people who say, if it's not this way, it's wrong. That's the mentality. That's the mindset of these people. You also have the word believe. This is a little unusual. Believed is expressed with the perfect tense. We've seen that perfect tense before in a lot of different places. It suggests a continuing state. So if you had that long-standing belief and you believe that it is necessary, these fellows were really entrenched. Well, doesn't that make sense? When they're up there at Antioch arguing with the Apostle Paul, who's inspired of God, you would think that he would have been able to shut them down. But they had this belief and they were going to cling to it regardless. People sometimes still have that same idea today, and that's really unfortunate. All right, Betty, let's go back to you as far as the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 12. This is a passage that typically doesn't get studied too much, but when you look at it in terms of Acts chapter 15, it helps explain why things were as I just described. These fellows have this long-standing belief, and they are standing on this. They're basically staking their life on this position. Why would they do that? Galatians 6 and verse 12 helps us.
As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they compel you to be circumcised, only that they may not be persecuted for the cross of Christ.
Okay, divide that verse in half, if you would.
As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they compel you to be circumcised.
Okay, let's stop you right there. Let's take that second part of the thought. They compel you to be circumcised. Well, okay, that's what we're seeing in Galatians 15, Acts 15, isn't it? They are telling these Gentiles, you must be circumcised and keep other parts of the law. That's clear. But what's the first part of Galatians 6:12 say? Let's read that once again.
As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh.
Okay, make a show in the flesh. What's that sound like? All right, there's that. Anything else? All right. Or we might add to that, boast and brag. How could the Jews have boasted and bragged when it came to compelling Gentiles to keep parts of the Mosaic Law? How could they boast and brag?
I've been circumcised and under the law, and that's what you're supposed to be following.
That's a good start to the discussion. Can anybody take it one step further? That's the second part of the point that we want. So just put that in the back burner for now. You're right, but we need to hold that thought for a bit. You go out and fish. You go out and fish with five or six other people. At the end of the day, what happens? At least you compare, right? I caught two fish. That's nothing. I caught 10. Well, you might have caught 10, but what happened with me? I only got one, but I got this monster catfish. The thing is 10 pounds. So your little 10 bluegill, they don't count at all. Can you imagine how the Jews must have been able to boast? Don't we find Jewish boasting in the Old Testament and the New? What do we find with Jesus? What did the Jews do? Look at me. I'm a Pharisee. Jesus said they wanted the salutations in the marketplace. They wanted all of the accolades and so forth. If you're able as a Jew to go out and you start converting these Gentiles, not only to Christ, but you impose the Mosaic law on them, how do you look in the eyes of others? Man, he's a pretty good worker for God, isn't he? So that's what Paul says. Part of what they were doing was designed to make them look good in the eyes of others. That's a problem for us, isn't it? You remember the Sermon on the Mount? What did Jesus say? You're going to give? Don't let this hand know what this hand is doing. You're going to pray? Don't go out to the marketplace and show off. Go where? Go to a private place and pray. So this was problem number one, but perhaps it wasn't the greatest problem. Let's go back to that verse again, Betty. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 12.
As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they compel you to be circumcised, only that they may not be persecuted.
Okay, now this is going to require a little more thought, but Carroll was headed in the right direction with it. He talks about they compel Gentiles to keep the law and then connects that with the idea of persecution. How would the two go together?
See, I'm keeping the law. I've been circumcised. So, and
Yes. Here it is. And here is a really, really good lesson for a lot of people, including all of us. If you're a word Jew, and you're someone who wants to maintain your standing in the community, perhaps you're a business person or got some friends and they've not come to Christ, and they're giving you all these hassles about being a Christian, what can you say? Well, yes, I do believe in Jesus, and yes, I was baptized, but do you know what I do last week? I found three Gentiles who had been baptized too, and what did I do? I compelled them to be circumcised. Well, if you're the Jew who's not a Christian, what are you thinking? All right, he's not so bad. We can tolerate that. Here is an example of people trying to take God's law and somehow mess with it. They're thinking we can figure out a compromise. We can straddle the fence, so to speak. So we can follow Christ, but we'll also impose the law on the Gentiles, and that way we'll be able to get along with people. This isn't the only time that we read about this thing. Think about the book of Revelation, as we've talked about from the chapters 2 and 3, the seven churches of Asia. Emperor worship was a big thing. Once a year, you just go out and pinch a little incense to Caesar. You say, Caesar is Lord. You get your trade certificate, and you can buy and sell and transact all the business that you need to in the empire. God said, don't do that. Christ is Lord, not Caesar. But can you imagine some Christians, as they went out, how they probably justified that? Well, I'll do it, but what am I really not doing? I'll pinch the incense, but in my mind, who's the only Lord? It's Christ. This is just a physical act. People try to walk the fence. Isn't that what we find in life today? Christianity and American culture oftentimes is seen in view of just, let's straddle the fence. And God says that never works. All right, Betty, one more time if you would, in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 15.
For neither is circumcision anything, nor uncircumcision, but a new creature.
Okay, Paul, as he talks about this, Galatians is really helpful to study in terms of what we have in Acts chapter 15. He says circumcision used to be beneficial to the Jews in the past, but he says what's true now. In Christ, if you're a Christian, circumcision, it's nothing. If you're circumcised, that's okay. If you're not circumcised, that's okay. There is no spiritual value whatsoever in the physical act. Now, as you look at what's taking place in Jerusalem, I think that you have at least three meetings, maybe four. In Acts chapter 15 and verse 4, you have the first assembly. They come together at Jerusalem. They're received in the church. That would be meeting number one. There's some stuff that happens there. I think meeting number two is suggested not only in the text, but especially in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 2. Betty, let's go back there one more time.
Galatians 2:2. Bearing one another's
burden. Or no, Galatians 2:2, I'm sorry.
And I went up by revelation, and I laid before them the gospel, which I preached among the Gentiles, privately before them.
Okay, now think about what's taking place here. There's this big issue. They all go up there. They meet everybody initially. And then it looks like from Galatians 2:2, they slide off for a private meeting. Paul's going to talk to the apostles on his own. Why do that? All right, you're headed in the right direction. Anybody want to advance the thought just a little further? Well, perhaps. If these fellas have come up from Jerusalem and said, hey, we're from Jerusalem, the apostles are still there, and we're teaching this doctrine, at least implied that they had the approval of the apostles in Jerusalem, it would have been very useful for Paul to have a private meeting with all the other apostles and say, hey, guys, guess what? I was up in Antioch with Barnabas, returned from the first missionary journey. We got these fellas. They said they came up from Jerusalem. They've got approval for this doctrine. Any of you guys supportive of that? Let's figure out if we have a problem among the apostles before we go any further. And then, do you remember what we said about Titus? Who else is on this delegation? Titus. Titus, circumcised or not? Not. So it seems to me that Titus was something like a test case. Perhaps Titus also came into that assembly with Paul and the apostles, and Paul was able to say, this is what's happened. I've got this fellow here by the name of Titus. He's a Christian, a Gentile, uncircumcised. Is there anybody in the group that thinks he needs to be circumcised? Is there anybody in the group that thinks that Titus needs to follow the laws of Judaism? After those questions were asked, if the answer by everybody is no, then what do you have? You've got consensus. You've got all the apostles standing together. Now, if you have that, what kind of platform does that give you to work with as far as opposing the false teachers? Now you've got a massive force. It's not just Paul trying to talk to these guys. Now you have all the apostles standing together. And then it's time to go ahead and make sure that you've got the elders involved. So there's that warm-up meeting, private meeting from what we can tell. And then we'll get to this next time, Lord willing. Then they decide, let's go out and let's have this public meeting with the false teachers. Let's let them present their case. Well, that's fine, because you've already got everything lined up on your side. And they did give them an opportunity to speak. And then that's going to bring us into Peter. And it may be that there was a fourth meeting, and that fourth meeting, we'll talk about that a little bit more next time. The fourth meeting may have been after the false teacher spoke, or that fourth meeting may have been sort of an offshoot of the third, where the false teachers speak and several people are allowed to hear that, because this was not something that needed to be kept in a corner. This was something that needed to be publicized. Everybody needed to know as far as what was right with the Gentiles. Carol?
This private meeting, would it also have provided them with a less confrontational meeting, so that if there was anything that anybody disagreed with, they might feel less attacked and more willing to open up?
Very possibly. Think about it in terms of management today. If you have the management needing to meet with the employees in a factory, management oftentimes will meet first and say, is everybody on board? Is there somebody that's shaky on this? Do we have anything to iron out? And once management is fully on board, then they'll go out and talk to the employees, and you can have that public meeting, and because you've got all the management thinking in the same terms and headed in the same direction, whatever problems that come up in the meeting, you still have that good resource to fall back on as far as everybody trying to head the group in the same basic direction. Anybody else? Ray, final thought?
Is there any